Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Election Day, Tuesday, the 3rd of April. This hour of the program, Aung San Suu Kyi has been hailing the beginning of a new era in Burma's politics after the country's election commission confirmed that her party had won a spectacular 40 out of 45 parliamentary seats in Sunday's election. We are going to talk about Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize laureate who was held under house arrest for some 10 years, and look at a part of the country that fascinates us. Her story does as well, and yet we don't know very much about it because it's been pretty much closed off to the world for a number of years. Our guest, lo and behold, has just returned to Singapore from Myanmar or Burma. She observed the election in Burma in the capital city and also visited a northern town where there was a close race. Our guest is Bridget Welsh, Associate Professor of Political Science at Singapore Management University, where she teaches courses on comparative politics, parties, political participation, gender, and international relations. She is the Malaysian director of the Asia Barometer Survey Project, and she's currently studying women in politics in Southeast Asia and has ongoing projects examining Islamist parties, vigilante violence in Indonesia, and political conditions in Myanmar, Burma. She has lived all over the world. She was raised abroad and lived in South America, the Middle East, the Caribbean, Europe, and Southeast Asia, and she joins us today by phone from Singapore. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Bridget Welsh. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Welsh, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So you went there to watch the elections.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a historic moment in Burma, Myanmar's history, and it was important to be there and to actually to see what was happening in terms of how, whether or not the process was free and fair and whether or not voters were really having a choice.
And was it free and fair?
I think it was a free election in the sense that people voted the choices that they wanted, but I don't think it was a fair election in that there were real irregularities in the polls, especially until the last week of the up to the week of the campaign started. There was intimidation, there were problems with the voter list, there was limits on campaigning, and that ended the week before when the president came out and made a speech and really sort of laid down the gauntlet that this was going to open up and invited international observers. But in the whole campaign period, one cannot necessarily say that it was fair.
Mm-hmm.
And in the rural areas, there was more, still fear. Even in the areas where people made their choices, they did so, with a sort of quiet resolve because there's an apprehension that the results would not be accepted as they were in 1990. They weren't accepted, so they still went ahead and voted, but there was still some doubt, especially in the more rural areas.
There are so many things that are striking about this story. Certainly, Aung San Suu Kyi's story is just remarkable, and the images that we saw over the weekend during the voting where people got dressed in their Sunday best and were marching to the polls was just extraordinary.
It was a pivotal moment for people. I mean, I think, for many people, this was a moment where they could actually feel that they could speak out freely and express the long-standing hopes that they had for the country's history. And Aung San Suu Kyi, she represents that hope for people. They called her Mother Sue or Sister Sue. They saw her as a mother figure, someone who can actually save the country from the hardship that they experience in their everyday lives. And so whether or not it was in her constituency of Kamu or other areas where she only visited maybe once, they felt this was election about was about her and what they hoped, what she represented for them for the future. And in the sense that these voters, when they knew this was an opportunity for them to really address the wrongs of the past as well. She was denied the election in 1990, and I think this was the first time that they could actually really send a signal that was open about what was done so wrong 22 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Is it unusual in Burma for a woman to achieve this kind of political prominence?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, of all the countries in Southeast Asia, and partly because this government has been a military government, you know, there's only 4% of the parliament is actually women. And so there are very few women representatives. What was striking about this election is that the NLD, the National League for Democracy, which was Aung San Suu Kyi's is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, they feel that almost half of their candidates were women. So you actually now have a record number of women going into the legislature that you didn't see before. And the opposition, for the first time, started to feel some women. So you not only have Aung San Suu Kyi as a woman leader, which, of course, you know, is common in terms of the pattern that is actually norm in Asia, which is a daughter or a wife of a previous leader. She is a daughter of famous General Aung San. But at the same time, you also have a lot of other women going into parliament, which even though this election was still only 9% of the parliament, you know, at least a third of those that are going in are women. So we actually see a change at the top and also some from below.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, I think the National League of Democracy, in terms of choosing their candidates, they decided on two criteria. One is the criteria was that they wanted to bring in young people because they know that their party actually needs to rejuvenate. And so they have a number of younger people that were slated, even in the most difficult races, to try to bring and galvanize among young people. And what we saw in the campaign were lots of young people being part of the caravans and the rallies, which, you know, and there was music and hip-hop. There was a hip-hop artist that was part of one of the candidates that was slated by the National League of Democracy. So they that was one of their criteria. And the second criteria was to put women candidates. And the third criteria was, when possible, to put an ethnic minority. So they used, in a sense, a certain degree of affirmative action towards the criteria they felt would help to be more representative and actually more rejuvenating in terms of the party as a whole.
Please refresh our memories of how she came to be and for how long she was under house arrest.
Well, you know, she rose to prominence in politics in 1990, where she was came back to visit Myanmar right after the 1988. Actually, she came back in 1988 when her mother was ill, and she decided to basically stay there. And she was she began to become the symbolic leader for the opposition and ran in the 1990 election. So she herself wasn't a candidate, but her party was, and her party won a decisive victory with an overwhelming majority of the vote, which the military decided to not put in. And then, in the 1990s, she was put under house arrest after that election, and she was let out in the early 2000s, 2002, for 2 years, and then she was put again back into house arrest. And she only was released less than a year ago, in fact. And in that context, she was actually, you know, she spent most of her last 20 years in jail. And for different periods of time, she was let out. But, you know, she's been really isolated. But the fact that she was willing to sacrifice herself, I mean, even when her husband was dying of cancer and the government was offering to let her leave and refusing to allow him to visit her, she chose to stay with her country and to stand up for the principles that she believed in. This is what made her such an iconic figure and someone that the people in the country, Burma, Myanmar, really connect to, because they know that she put them first.
And tell me what influences on her helped form her political viewpoint.
Well, a lot of it, is her father. I mean, her father was, although she was extremely young when he was assassinated in the late 1940s, as a result of as the independence movement was moving forward and they were about to get independence in 1947. He was an influencing figure for her because he was one of the key leaders of the independence movement who really brought together different ethnic minorities and was part of the group of generals. So I think he himself was important. Her mother was an ambassador to India for the government and was also an important factor. But I think, you know, after that, she really, you know, she had two children and even she was not as involved in politics. It was only really in 1988 that she began to, you know, to take on that role and she started to study and wrote a series of books like Freedom from Fear, which allowed her to kind of articulate her thoughts and to point out what were her ideas of future. And you know, this is the key things that she focused on was to bringing about democracy, bringing about freedom, And that in herself were her ideas that, you know, became very well known within her society, she became this particular leader by pushing for wanting to have space and wanting to have a free and fair electoral process of where people could be represented fairly.
And where are her children now, Bridget?
Both of them are in London, I understand. One of them came to see her. I think for both of her children, it was a very difficult process because they were separated from her, at pivotal times in their lives, and for such a long time. And they were never, they wrote letters, but they were never really allowed to communicate the way that, rarely to talk on the phone. And that was part of the isolation that she had to experience. Messages were passed through other people. And, put a particular strain because I think her children also were quite at least one of her children was upset that she didn't come to visit the father when the father was dying of cancer. But, I think she still has a good relationship with both of her children. And I think they understand the reasons that she's done what she's done because she feels, they identify with what the important issues that she stands for, which is that not only her principles, but also to stand up for, to be that figure to pull people together. And I think that's very important in a multi-ethnic country like Myanmar.
So how significant was the election in terms of moving the country toward democracy, or is it still a long, long haul?
Both, actually. I think it was a very insignificant marker. I think it's a significant marker in two ways. First, it brings Aung San Suu Kyi into parliament and her party into the political process formally. I think this is something that cannot be underrated because you now have an official leader of the opposition, a unifying figure in the system who can actually raise concerns with the legitimacy that she already had, but now she has in terms of the rule of law and from an electoral mandate that's been refreshed in this particular way. I think it's also important in that you actually had a relatively free election. Yes, I think there was problems with fairness, but overall, this election was really one of the strongest elections, the most open elections that the country has had since 1990. And I think that's an important step because as the next elections are held in 2015 for all the seats, then I think that this is a standard that they will have to kind of either match or at least even expand on in order to gain the legitimacy in the next round. And I think so that's this precedent is important. At the same time, it is important to recognize that this election did not change the balance of power within the system. The incumbent party, which is largely a military government that has become civilian, but still former military people, although many civilians are now within it, are in control. They have 81% of the parliament, of which 25% of those seats are given to the military. So in a sense, they have the decision-making power, and they control the institutions, be they how weak they are, but they still have the decisive power. And they have a constitution that is written so that the military can intervene at any time. So the rules are stacked against the democratic process and democratic voices. So I think you have quite a limited structure. In that context, we do have, I think one can call this, Myanmar Burma's Gorbachev. President Thein Sein is the person who has been the architect who has been pushing very hard for the reform process since August. He had a lot vested in having Aung San Suu Kyi to come into parliament, and today he acknowledged her victory. And he acknowledged the process, so he accepted the results. So you do have people within the system that want changes, but it still is a military system, a military predominant system, which I think will take a long time to change. There has not been yet what we can call a transition election, a change of power. And I think that is the next step that is actually crucial.
So how does she go about pushing for further reform as a member of a minority in the parliament?
Well, I think she's going to have to build allies. And I think there are a lot of allies within the system, within the parliament, because the USDP, which is the party of the military, which is the one running against the NLD, they brought in civilians. So there's a good cohort of people who are actually technically having the military label, but in fact, actually, if they had their choice, probably would not have chosen that. And I think we learned in this election that a lot of people who actually have the military cloak and have the and work as civil servants for the government, they are actually supporters of the NLD. When the National League of Democracy can win the seats in the national capital, where all the government servants are, people who are given plots of land by the government, you know there's a lot of support within the government. That's the same thing within Parliament. The Parliament actually will need to gallon, you know, she will have to work with the people who want to listen and engage with her. The other group that is actually very important that I haven't mentioned yet, which I think is absolutely critical, are the ethnic minority parties. And they control a lot of it, especially at the, in the ethnic minority states, a large share of the votes. And here is where she can make allies and actually start to actually address some of the problems and actually build a cohort of people for a kind of national reconciliation agenda to move the process forward.
And tell me more about those ethnic minority parties. Who are the ethnic minorities?
Well, there are lots of ethnic minorities in Myanmar, but most of them are concentrated in the peripheral states of the country. The states that they have that are the most problematic is known now as the Kachin state. The Kachin state is where they have still fighting. And there were supposed to be 48 seats that were supposed to be contested yet on April 1st, but in fact only 45 were, because three of them were not contested because there's fighting and they have not reached any peace agreement in that particular state. So this has been ongoing and quite a tense environment. But there are other states in the Rakhine or Arakan state, the Mon in the south, the Shan, the Waf, just to name a few of the major ethnic groups. And each of these ethnic groups have political parties. And political parties are organized around that respective group. And they represent themselves at the national parliament, and they also represent at what we call the regional parliaments at the state level, which, of course, we would consider this in the context of the United States state legislative assemblies, state House of Representatives. So we have these large ethnic parties and representations of which are actually representing these different regions across the different peripheral zones. And these regional zones, such as the Kachin state and places like the Shan state, are actually very important for the economy of Burma, Myanmar, because they are where many of the natural resources are. And that's where they're contested by the military, because this is where they get their money. So, and this is where a lot of the ethnic problems and a lot of the fighting has taken place. So it will be very important for Aung San Suu Kyi to actually, for the questions of national stability, but also for the perspective of national cohesion, and for her to be able to work with these ethnic minorities in an effective manner and actually help to address that particular pressing problem of the issues of conflict, the issues of representation, and issues of discrimination for these particular regions.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll do it in just a moment. Bridget Welsh joining us by phone from Singapore today. She was in Burma, Myanmar, for the elections as an observer. She's an associate professor of political science at Singapore Management University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to use an email, you could do that. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, of course, Election Day in Wisconsin, and tomorrow during this time period, we'll have three guests who will be dissecting the results. Chuck Kornbach will be joining us, Mike Goucher, and Kathleen Dolan. Let's go to phone calls. Tim and Ladysmith, our first caller, Bridget. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think your guest probably answered my question, but Burma, Myanmar has become one of, according to Voice of the Martyrs and Open Doors International, one of the worst countries in the entire world right now of the persecution and brutality toward Christians. And I'm wondering, obviously, your guest seemed to indicate that there's not really a big reform taking place at this point, but I was wondering if she can address that, if there seems to be any hope of that changing at all.
That's a good question, and I think it's very well received. I think we've seen these problems very acutely in the Kachin State, where the Kachin State has a large Christian community, and that's part of why we see a lot of the problems of issues of religious intolerance, issues of religious freedom, and religious persecution concentrated in the states that have had these conflict in these ethnic minority areas, especially places like the Kachin. What we have seen in the last 5 years has been, and in particular in the last couple years, a bit more thawing of that. Now, there's clearly serious problems in the sense that there have been, you know, longstanding patterns of discrimination of which religion gets compounded in terms of one of the elements of dealing with the issues of ethnic minorities, of which the majority of the community is Burmese, and they are Buddhist, and they actually look at all the other religions, Christians and Muslims, another important group, are actually seen in a very particular a negative light, and they're not included into government and many of the other issues that I've just raised. But there has been a thawing of that. And I think at least under the as the reform process, which began really in August of last year, I think the government has actually really worked hard to try to have negotiations and discussions. And that's put the religious issues back on the table in a substantive way. I mean, there's not a resolution to that. But I'm much more optimistic about these issues than I would have been a year ago, because there is a sense of wanting to give power to the ethnic minorities in terms of greater representation than there was before, because they're still wanting to have some sort of resolution to these issues, which is really a change from the previous policy, which was one of kind of confrontation and forced assimilation and, of course, brutality in that process. We do have a long way to go, however, in order to address these issues, especially in the areas where conflict is existing, especially in particular in the Kachin State.
Anything else, Tim? Tim is gone. Thanks very much for your call. What sanctions have we and other countries imposed on Burma?
Well, the two groups that have sanctioned Myanmar, Burma have been the European Union and, of course, the United States. The United States has a whole series of sanctions. Most of the sanctions have come through Congress, which involve the issues of investment. U.S. government is not allowed to invest in Burma. I mean, U.S. businesses, they're not allowed to have direct relations with the funding that goes directly to the government. Of course, we've also had a whole series of what we call financial transactions sanctions, which limit the exchange of capital, exchange of currency, and also basically challenge specific leaders who are not allowed to actually come to the United States and not allowed to actually to move their money into different sets of accounts because of the sanctions that are in place that actually prevent the flow of revenue. And these have been very well endorsed by both the president as well as Congress. In the sense that they actually have, they've been part of the tools that the United States has used to send a very clear message that they don't like the government, and they didn't like the way that the government has actually been not allowing democracy. One of the reasons we have to recognize that the government is actually pushing forward on these democratic reforms is the hope that these sanctions will be eased and removed, because this current government is trying to actually stimulate economic growth and bring in investment, and they know they can't do that until those sanctions are removed. The European Union, as well as the Australian government, have also had sanctions, and they have largely had a similar both financial as well as investment. I think that the European Union probably will start to make a quicker removal of those sanctions after this election. I think the U.S. will be much less and slow in that process because it's more of a wait-and-see type of approach. But I think that it is consciously a calculated strategy to allow these elections to move forward in order to create a more conducive environment for economic reforms in the country, because the country needs economic reforms as much as it needs political reforms, because there is actually very serious problems in terms of poverty and lack of investment, a mismanagement of funding, a failure of economic institutions. There isn't even an effective banking system. So I think there's a hope that this can actually kind of integrate Myanmar, Burma into a much more the global economy in the long run, and this is an important first step in that regard. Mm.
So sanctions have been all important.
They have been, and I think they've been a tool. They've been a tool to send a message by the U.S. government, but they haven't. Also, I think it's important to recognize that they've been important in other ways, and that the United States and the West have been basically pushing themselves out of the equation because the other party that goes in and is the key investor in the country is China. And China is very eager to take these natural resources. And Myanmar, Burma is very rich in resources. It has oil, it has gas, it has, you know, trees and gems and all the other things that are very lucrative. And, of course, especially the oil and gas and access to the sea port, the sea for Western China has been very important. And what we've seen as these reforms have started last August and now extended through now, there's been a conscious move by the current Burmese government led by Thein Sein to move away from China and move towards the West, and the hope that the West will actually respond positively, because they recognize there's some concern that China has too much power over Myanmar and it has too much investment in the country, and that, and in fact, that they would like to see more diversity in that investment, because a lot of that investment is in natural resources, which doesn't really have the spillover for ordinary people the way that other investment can in terms of manufacturing or potentially in areas of small and medium businesses or services.
So how has China responded to that move toward the West?
Not very well.
I would imagine.
There was a big controversy, which is what started this, a lot of these reforms in August of last year, and that involved the Minso Dam, which is a very critical dam project in the Kachin state, which is, of course, contributing to the problems in the Kachin, where a lot of people were forcibly relocated and so forth. And the current president decided to suspend the project. And, of course, that was a key signal that was sent to China that they weren't going to get their way all the time. And, in fact, that there were concerns within the government, this current government, that the environmental aspects that were involved, this would have dammed the two rivers that formed the Irrawaddy, which is the main river in the country. You know, there was a lot of response that this could have potentially negative impact on the rice and the farmers and also, you know, affect the country as a whole. So I think the Chinese have now had to do some reconfiguring, but they have a lot of money. For example, in the deep sea port, they have $85 billion U.S. dollars of investment.
Woo.
In this new DC port. And we're talking, this is not small change. And in this regard, you know, they have those interests, and they will protect them. So it would be a misnomer to say that the China-Myanmar relationship is fundamentally changed. They're still very closely connected to the system, and they rely on them. But I think the government wants to diversify that investment. And I think they want to, they would like it to be, to have some checks on the economic growing power that the Chinese are gaining within their country, because they want to have control over their own country, which is understandable.
We go to Mike in Oconomowoc. Hi, Mike. Are you there, Mike? Mike is not there. He wanted to mention, I don't know where he went, Bhutto in Pakistan, another strong woman. Are there any similarities here?
I think so, in the sense that she was, she was a father, a famous figure, Azia. But I think in some ways there are a couple important differences. I mean, I think unlike Benazir Bhutto, Aung San Suu Kyi has really done her time, and that means literally and figuratively, you know, by being under house arrest for such a long period of time. And, you know, she actually, to a certain degree, comes in with a much cleaner record than Benazir did. Even though Benazir, you know, was a very important figure for Pakistan, Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, has in some ways, she has a tabula rasa, and since she doesn't have the corruption, doesn't have the baggage that some of her family members have, that so in a sense she actually, I think, has even more space to be able to carry out things than I compare to Benazir. But she also, in some ways, she's hampered by the fact that she has been isolated, so she will really heavily depend on who she brings with her and the people she and their ability to be able to kind of galvanize a new legislative agenda that will actually push things forward.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about the elections in Myanmar, Burma. Over the weekend, striking elections, democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi's victory has been described as really the biggest prize of her political career. We're looking at how many seats she won and how it's really an uphill battle the democracy movement in Burma is. But her story is so remarkable, and we focused a lot of attention on that part of the world because of, against all odds and great hardship in her life, the democracy movement that continues. Our guest has just returned to Singapore, where she lives, from Burma, where she was an observer for the elections over the weekend. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Bridget Welsh is our guest, Associate Professor in Political Management, Singapore Management University. We've heard over the years of the great number of political prisoners and the harsh conditions, the rapes that have taken place. Is there a let-up in those kinds of atrocities? Are people being released from prison? Is the military a little kinder?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, one has to recognize for them to get to where they have been in terms of being able to allow this process to move forward, they've had to let out a lot of political prisoners. And I think one of the things that people is important to appreciate about the NLD, I mentioned earlier that some of the criteria for selecting their candidates was youth and ethnicity and gender. But the main criteria was that they are loyal to the party and have done their time. A good part, most of the candidates that they slated had been in political prisoner for some period of time, whether or not it was 2 years, whether or not it was 10 years. And they were, this was part of the credentials of being part of the part of the party. And, unlike Aung San Suu Kyi, who, of course, had a tremendous challenge as being under house arrest, many of these candidates were not under house arrest. They were in the prisons that we can only describe as horrendous, facing very difficult conditions, and they persevered, and in some ways the NLD chose to recognize that because that's where a lot of the loyalty and the solidarity of people who were on the front line for the party were actually in prison. Now, you have, in the context of understanding Myanmar, Burma, one has to appreciate that there are a lot of different groups of opposition besides the NLD. The most important and most famous one, of course, was Generation 88, which are the leaders and the student leaders who are different, though, from the NLD in the sense that they were not running for parliament in the same way. They did not contest in this election. The NLD really pushed ahead, although one of the candidates in the NLD was a former 88 student leader. You also have, of course, as I mentioned earlier, ethnic minorities. And this election was not an election about ethnic minorities. It was an election about the NLD in the sense that only a handful of seats were in the ethnic minority areas. And so only one of the candidates is actually an ethnic minority leader that is actually from the opposition side. So you actually, there are other aspects of the opposition besides the NLD. But all of them, of course, faced very significant and serious constraints. There are the most recent event before this election and opening up, of course, was the 2007, what we know as the Saffron Revolution. This is when the monks went out into the streets to protest the fuel prices and the conflict that happened with the monks in the northern state. Interestingly enough, one of the seats that was contested in this by-election was in the state of Pukuku, which is actually where the conflict over the Saffron Revolution was started, and you can guarantee that the NLD won that seat as well, as that community sent a clear signal they didn't like what the government did in 2007, which involved massive arrests of monks and massive arrests and killings and infiltrations into the monasteries. So I think there's a lot of issues at hand here. There has been, besides the issues that you mentioned in terms of rapes, which are, questions of impunity are still outstanding, questions associated with prisoner areas, the big change that I think is important to appreciate that has happened in the last 6 months is that you actually have tremendous press freedom in the country that had, this is a country that you didn't really have the internet that was really functioning till a few years ago.
Really?
In most parts of the country, it wasn't even functioning. In the little town that I visited in the north of Mitila, I was asking people how often the internet works and how long has it been there. And they said about a year and a half, two years, but not really working. And it's only in the last 6 months that you could actually access sites like National Public Radio or BBC or CNN. So, this is, in a sense, a revolutionary change in the experience of ordinary people because they actually have access to information that they'd never been allowed to before. And I think I use this example of the media freedom as an illustration of how things are opening up in a, compared to where they were before, compared to where they are now. But people worry because they've been through so much. I mean, the government, the military government, has essentially been in power since 1962. And it still is in power. And I think we have to remember that, no matter what all of this opening up. And there's been a situation where people have had power and had opening, and then the system has closed down again. Mm-hmm. And they've seen it. They've lived it. You know, and each time when they're given a chance, the Burmese people, they send a signal that it's when in a free election, they've had two. In 1990 and in these small by-elections. And you can tell that what that signal was. Overwhelmingly, they said to the government, we don't like you, we want someone else.
They've all been through so much. That is an understatement, probably. She's been through so much. The people have been through so much. Tell me more about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit and the substance of her conversations with Aung San Suu Kyi.
Well, of course... We don't know exactly what was said, but we do know that in parts I can speak from some of the issues in the campaign, and then I'll go back to the substance. And that what was striking to me was that I was in one village, and I went to see. Of course, I visited both sides, the USDP and the NLD office. But I went into this NLD office in the middle of some rural village that could only be described as 8.5 hours from, you know, from the capital, and you know, it's a very, very dusty and very hot road. I went into the into this office, and what did I see? A picture of Hillary Clinton.
Oh my!
And I thought to myself, well, here's something in this context. And it wasn't a small picture. It was quite a big one. So I think that they saw this as actually very important. I think that they see the West as an important player. And I think what there are a couple things that I would highlight about, to me, not necessarily the substance of the discussion, but the substance of what the trip meant. And that I think, Hillary Clinton's visit did two things. It recognized and acknowledged that the reforms were ongoing. She had a good relationship and good conversation with Thein Sein, who was the president, and actually she put a lot of faith in him as an individual. And I think that helped to boost the reform process and give him, because, you know, he also faces a lot of resistance from inside. And so I think this was an important element. And, of course, she continued to show her commitment to Aung San Suu Kyi by publicly recognizing her and speaking to her and pressing for the issues of pushing for freedoms in her meetings. And she is, you know, not only has she visited, not only other international leaders have visited, but also the envoy, Derek Mitchell, and many other U.S. officials have been constantly streaming in, as has there been an increase in U.S. aid to try to expand civil society and to begin to try to help the reform process to be something more substantive. So I think that, and that's the third thing that I would highlight about Hillary Clinton's visit, is that she basically started to set in place conditions to actually expand U.S. engagement not only with the NLD, but also with the system as a whole. And I think that that was an important step. Of course, the government was talking about sanctions, and I think Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration will now have to make an assessment of how to move forward. And I think the government in Myanmar, Thein Sein in particular, will be expecting some sort of opening. But it's very difficult for the U.S. to roll back sanctions because they're so institutionalized in many different aspects of government. And, of course, it would take a change from Congress. And I think the Congress, understandably, is because there's a history here. They don't want to act too soon because they will be removing the leverage that they have in a country where they have so limited leverage. But I think, you know, from the perspective of Obama and Clinton and Clinton's visit, I think it was an important to do it at the time to push and to show that the United States recognized the reform process, but at the same time also recognized the importance of the opposition leader and wanting to move the country forward. I think they send the right signal. Now it's a question of whether or not they're going to continue to send those right signals and by actually moving the process forward further, because it's very easy to have a by-election when only 9% of the seats are up for grabs, and no matter who, if, even if they won all of them, which they almost did, right? Even if won all of them, it still wouldn't have changed the power. But the question is the stuff ahead, which is the economic reforms and the real and the 2015 elections, where all the seats are up for grabs. That's where the real test will be.
Bridget Welsh is our guest this hour, associate professor in political science at Singapore Management University. The National League for Democracy, the NLD, won 40, at least, of the 45 seats being contested in Burma, Myanmar's by-elections this week. And we are looking at the pro-democracy leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and the elections of the week and trying to find out more about this democracy movement in Burma. It's really a fascinating story, isn't it? If you'd like to join the conversation, feel free. If you'd just like to listen, that's A-OK, too. But here is our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Earl Scruggs, influential, helpful, and humble banjo player. No one will ever play the banjo like Earl, Charlie Daniels said. We are going to talk about his life. He died last Wednesday at the age of 88. We'll listen to some of his music, and we'll have two guests who are musicians themselves and who have written eloquently about the life of Earl Scruggs in the last... Well, for years, actually, but a lot of ink over the last week. All right, more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I was going to ask your guest why Burma gets so much negative focus on the military when in the last three or four years in Thailand there was a military coup, and you really don't hear the U.S. chastising Thailand for the military throwing out Thaksin Shinawatra, who was democratically elected prime minister. Now his sister has been elected, but it seems like the military in Thailand doesn't get chastised at all.
I think that's a really good question. I think the government did come out very cautiously after the coup in 2006. And I think what was different about Thailand were a couple points. First of all, the society was very divided over Thaksin. And they weren't, you know, there was a, and in some ways the U.S. government, you know, didn't really have that great a relationship with Thaksin. So in a sense, they there was very strategic interests that were at play, and they wanted to kind of wait and see how things were unfolding in terms of the polarization that existed in the society between what was known as the Reds, which are Thaksin supporters, and the Yellows, which are the more royalist, more conservative forces. But I think substantively, in the context of Thailand, which has had 19 political coups, you've seen people come in and then they go back out. And so a lot of the sense was that the military wasn't going to be around for very long, and it wasn't around for very long in the sense that they did step back out, although party that came in afterwards, the Democrats, did so with a, basically what we call a judicial coup in the sense that they really didn't have a good mandate. But in that context, you actually, you know, the military has not been seen as destructive a force for democracy in the sense that it's stepped back. And it's also not been seen, compared to Myanmar Burma, as having the same level of atrocities and human rights abuses. And, you know, we're really talking about, you know, very big differences in the context of what the Burmese military has done historically versus the Thai military in terms of how it affected society. But I think this gentleman's comment was actually just spot on, in that you do have a double standard in this regard. And part of that has been fueled by the fact that you've had an iconic figure in Myanmar, like Aung San Suu Kyi, that has galvanized attention over and really, you know, around the issues of democracy in that country. And you don't quite have that iconic figure in the context of Thailand because you don't have the same degree of brutality and conditions that are so intense.
Thank you, John, very much for the call. Is there too much focus on her as the leader of this if she, for some reason, can't run for president or becomes ill? Does the movement fade away?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, what happens with iconic leaders such as people like Mandela or people like Aung San Suu Kyi is a lot of their party, you know, really revolves around them because their personality is so powerful. And I think there is concern that this party is really about her. And I will say of the 200 or so people that I spoke to and asked them how they were going to vote and the reasons they were going to vote one way or the other, you know, everyone said they voted for Aung San Suu Kyi. They voted because of Mother Sue and because of her. And so it really wasn't about, she could have had a totally different party's name. It really was about her pull factor.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question now is about whether or not she's able to, the young people who have come in, can establish themselves. It's understandable that most people don't even know who these people are because, you know, the party has had to work underground for so many years. It's only become registered in the last few months as it's kind of participating in the process. And so many people don't even really know who these people are besides maybe some of the people who have local candidates. And what happened in this election is that a lot of the candidates were parachuted from the capital, Rangoon, or now called Yangon. Actually, that's the main city. They had moved the capital to a place called Naypyi Taw, which is actually about 4 or 5 hours north of Yangon. But many of these individuals lived in the context of Yangon and came back to places where they might have been raised for a period of their life or went to school, and they became parachute candidates then. So now these people have to actually come to the fore and be able to be part of the process. And if they are part of the process in a particular way, then people will be able to see some of the diversity. I think where we're going to see the opposition evolve is how they work together and how they slate for the next election, which, of course, is 2015. What is important to realize is that almost all the other smaller opposition parties just didn't really make the grade this particular election in terms of the by-elections. So it's, in Myanmar, Burma, like many countries, has a lot of personality differences and fragmentations within the opposition. So I think we're going to see this is really going to be a test of her ability not only to rejuvenate and regenerate younger leaders, but also for her to be able to work with people across different personalities and mend some of the conflicts that she has or had with other individuals, especially those that were elected into parliament for the opposition in 2010, which her party chose to not contest in because they didn't think those elections were free and fair, which they weren't. And in that context, I think it's going to be interesting to see how she works ahead. Her health, overall, they say her health is okay, but this election campaign, she got sick because of sheer exhaustion. She vomited on the campaign side. She collapsed. She fainted. A lot of that had to do with the rigor of the campaign, and it is the hottest. It's a hot season. It's pretty much the hottest time of August, perhaps in Wisconsin.
Oh.
It was hot.
Or in March.
So it's a different season there in Myanmar, and it was quite difficult. You know, the sun is coming down for 4 or 5 hours, really, and there's no air conditioning and no electricity, and it's no wonder she faces those types of challenges. And I think people are concerned, but she's in her mid 60s, so she's still. I mean, someone says they always say how old she is, but my view, 66 is still young.
I'm with you on that. Let's go to June in Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, dear guest in Singapore. This is more a comment than a question. I saw when Hillary Clinton and Aung San Suu Kyi were coming out for a photo shoot after the meeting, and Hillary Clinton was staring at her with so much admiration. And after she'd been through the Syria question at the UN, you could just see the years drop away. And it was a wonderful moment.
Bridget.
Thanks very much for sharing that. I think that, Aung San Suu Kyi, she is a very inspirational person. She has that charisma, and she has that effect on people. And that's, I had the pleasure of meeting her, and I can say I probably didn't have quite the years fall off in terms of me, but I would say that, you can feel that spirit that this person has, this pull factor. And I think, that's what makes these elections so palpably historic. Because, you know, when you're around someone who can actually inspire that in other people, then I think there are so few people in the world historically that have been able to do that. And I think that that's what, you know, this makes these elections so exciting and so much so promising.
Yeah, there is something to the fact that she's from Burma, for heaven's sake, and she has the respect and interest of people all over the world. It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
It is. Go ahead.
No, I'm just thanking June very much for the call, and I'm going to thank you, Bridget, for being with us. What a perfect guest you were for this hour. Thank you. I learned so much, and it's just very fascinating that you were actually there looking at the elections. Thank you for being
here. It was great to be there. And thanks to your listeners for listening and yourself as well. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. Bridget Welsh, our guest. She's joining us by phone from Singapore, where I have no idea what time it is or what day it is. They're associate professor in political science at Singapore Management University, and she just returned to Singapore from observing the elections in Myanmar, Burma. She was in the capital city and also, as you heard her described, was traveling to fairly remote parts of the country. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and please stay with us. A tribute to Earl Scruggs, hour two of our show today. This is the Ideas Network.